But our first guests are an economist together with a performer. Why is an economist talking to us about music? Well, that's the riddle that Saul Eslak will deal with. He's well known as a commentator on things other than music. But when you team him up with Tanya de Jong from Potpourri, what do you get? Well, they think you get some sort of brain food. We'll find out when they join us as our first guests on The Conversation Hour today on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria and the World Wide Web. It's 11:15.
Nella fantasia, which means in our fantasies, we dream of a world that is transformed, full of love, harmony, and hope for the future. Music, of course, can take us to this wondrous place. So journey with us now through the world of musical imagination, wherein lie the seeds of infinite creation and joy. This is Nella Fantasia.
From Potpourri, Tanya de Jong and Saul Eslak, oddly. I don't think he sings. I'll ask him in a moment. But Tanya, welcome back to The Conversation Hour. What were we just listening to there?
That was Nella Fantasia, the title track of Potpourri's CD Nella Fantasia, released quite recently, about a year ago.
And is that going to be part of Opera Under the Stars in the Yarra Valley this weekend?
7th of March, Labor Day. We're doing Opera Under the Stars, and yes, that will be, I think, the opening piece.
That is Saturday. Look at that, Saturday, yeah. 7th of March. You think, yeah, I would have read that. Really? Sorry.
But I think, John, the really important thing with that concert is bringing people back to the Yarra Valley to support all of the wineries and B&Bs and restaurants that are losing so much business at the moment. And the roads are safe, and people are, the message is, come back and support the Yarra Valley as much.
Well, the roads are safe, but the Melbourne Highway earlier this morning was not safe. There was a burning tree that fell over and that shut it, but it's now open again. Saul, do you sing?
Badly. Could barely carry a tune in a bucket. But sometimes in the shower, sometimes if I'm in the car and no one else is, but otherwise not for public consumption.
Right. So you're like most of us, in fact.
In that respect, yes.
And yet you're teaming up with people who do nothing but sing. And why is that? Because you are an economist and well-known. People will say, Saul Eslak. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's the guy from the ANZ.
Well, yes, that's true. That's my main persona. But like some other economists in the past, including one who seems to be coming back into fashion, Maynard Keynes, I've had an interest over the years, not simply in music, but in other art forms as well. And one of the things I do on the side is chair the Tasmanian Arts Advisory Board, which advises the Tasmanian government on the distribution of state government money for a wide variety of artists, and that in turn stemmed out of some work and thinking I'd been doing over a long period of time as to why Tasmania, my home state, has been for so long the poorest in the country.
For artistically poorest?
No, in almost every respect, except perhaps quality of life.
It's got some very, very... I mean, the gallery and artistic space in Launceston that we saw not long ago is simply superb, the old railway workshops.
Indeed, and that in part reflects some of the progress that's been made in bringing the arts to the forefront of Tasmanian life over, well, probably 20 years or so. But the kind of thing I'd been thinking about for, I guess it's now 11 years, is why in an economic sense, in an educational sense, Tasmania had so long been lagging behind the rest of the country. And one of the conclusions I came to is that it is possible through creativity and innovation for places that are perceived as backwaters actually to improve their lot quite considerably. And I mean, Ireland is the textbook case of that. Although now it's been devastated by the financial crisis, for some time Iceland was seen as a potential in that way. Norway and Sweden have done it.
Iceland, and we don't
indeed,
talk about Iceland.
Not anymore, not in that context.
Not in your trade,
yes,
especially.
Maybe they've had too much innovation in the financial sense, and that's kind of brought them undone. But I was also very much attracted to the work of another economist in the United States, Richard Florida, who's been out to Australia several times, has worked with a number of state governments, including Victoria and South Australia, and who's done a lot of work on the role of creativity and innovation, in particular but not exclusively through the arts, in promoting growth in regional communities that you might not think would be at the forefront of life. His classic example was Pittsburgh, which you would think of as an Australian Wollongong, I guess. But like the Australian Wollongong and Newcastle, when the main industries pulled away and the towns were, the communities were feeling as though they had no future at all. City authorities and state authorities used the arts and used the idea of making these places as creative hubs to reinvent them.
So what sort of things will you be doing? I mean, do you sort of invent more choirs, bands? What's the sort of... How do you reinvent the cultural impact of in Tasmania? I mean, you've got the orchestra there now, and there's quite a lot going on in chamber music. What happens with, say, theatre, opera?
Well, there's more than that as well. And I mean, as I'm sure you know, Trevor, the TSO is a much loved by its own community and widely supported orchestra, which actually does a lot outside its own state as well too. Tasmania is now once again beginning to build a professional theatre company, the Tasmanian Theatre Company, and it has an innovative opera company, EHOS. It has two very...
Sorry, EHOS?
EHOS. It's based on a Greek word, but it does...
I was hoping it was based on something.
It actually, it's spelled out I-H-O-S.
Okay.
But that's just that's just what it's called. And
why
it
come
does
up with a name that no
opera.
One can understand or pronounce?
Well, that's part of the point. And Tasmania also has two strong dance companies, Taz Dance and Stompin, which is based in Launceston, and which specialises in bringing young people, teenagers and young adults, initially in as dancers and then teaching them other skills. And of course Tasmania is well known for its craft, and the agency which I'm a part-time chairman of has had a program now for about 10 years called Design Island, which is particularly about nurturing Tasmania's craftspeople, wood, stone, jewellery, that sort of thing, and taking that to the world, and through all of those things trying to change people's perception of Tasmania as a place.
So it's a community-based activity. Are all the communities involved in this?
It's spread across the state. Spread across the state. Government funding is important, but not the exclusive source of many of these things. Of course, the TSO, as you know, has considerable support from Canberra and through the Arts Council, but also has its own independent supporter base.
So, Tanya, how important is it to find someone like Saul who gets out of his comfort zone and is prepared to, from a business and, you know, high-flying commercial point of view, offer something up to what is otherwise a sometimes fairly naive art sector who don't understand the money side of things a lot?
Look, I think having people like Saul, and we have, I've just started, as you know, John, a new organisation called Creativity Australia to promote creative thinking and creative leadership to build a greater culture of innovation and productivity and greater well-being in workplaces. So Saul and I have talked about this sort of equation for quite a few years in different guises, back with Saul's an ambassador of the Song Room, which I founded 10 years ago. And we've had these conversations because we do need people like Saul talking back to the arts community, because even in the arts community, we were discussing this before, it is easy for large arts organisations also to become like other large organisations and not be as innovative as what they could be. But by the same token, I think we need to recognise that creativity doesn't just reside with artists as we perceive them. We all have the right side of the brain intact.
This is an intriguing thing. I don't know. I mean, Saul said before he can't sing for nuts.
Well, I think everyone can sing.
Well, there is this view, but in fact, despite people like you and maybe Trevor, who works with creatives all the time, there's a whole lot of people who don't have, to their knowledge, a creative bone in their body.
Well, of course, that I disagree with entirely. And last night I was giving a presentation to the Melbourne Business School, and I asked who in the room felt that they were creative. And actually, the majority, to their credit, put their hands up and said they were, and a few put...
But not with their accounting.
No, that's true.
That's what they go to business school to learn.
A few put up... I said, who doesn't feel creative? And they put up... A few kids put up their hands, and I said, well, why don't you? And they said, well, because we don't sing or do sculpture or write. And I said, well, the point is you can be creative as an HR manager or creative as a GP or creative as a CEO running an organisation, just as Trevor is with the MSO. Or you can be creative as an economist. It doesn't mean that you're going to muddle the figures, but it means that you think about things outside the square. And I think, John, the problem is that you might know of a 15-country study done by Cobus Neathling.
No, I haven't got a clue.
Okay, well, 3 to 5-year-olds supposedly exhibit about 98% creative behaviour. But then through our Industrial Revolution education system, which focuses on numeracy and literacy...
It hammers it out of them.
So by the time people are 25, yep. we're left with it about 2%. But it's not gone. It's not vanished. It's just not being nurtured.
No.
And so we need to use all of our creative capacities.
But how can you use your creative capacity working on stacking shelves in the supermarket? How do you use your creative capacity if you're on an assembly line in a factory or whatever it might be that is,
well,
in fact, the genuine rank and file of Australian employees are not managers, GPs, professionals. They're out there doing hard slog.
Well, I think it's finding other bits of yourself. So when you're at the assembly line, you may be still being creative because you're thinking about what you might be doing later that day that might be creative. Or to take it one step further, I think there'd be a lot of people who'd actually get better jobs from disadvantaged communities if they start to unlock a bit of their creative capacity, because it's going to immediately give them other skills and tools and greater self-esteem that's going to steer them in the direction of doing something that they really love. But we have the problem, I'm sure, in our major banks where 3,000 people are sitting in organisations, and many of those people feel isolated, lonely, like they're not unlocking their full potential as well, just as much as on assembly
lines.
They're
living in fear of the boss. But for instance, I have a friend who was in charge of a major organisation. And one day he went to work, he picked up a big book, put it on his head, balanced it on his head, and then walked through the main kind of cubicle area where everyone does their work, just to go to the lavatory with the book balanced on his head, went and did what he was going to the lavatory for, and then put the book back on his head and walked back to his office with the book on his head, didn't say a word to anyone, didn't look at anyone, just walked back, and then waited to see what the reaction was. Nobody said a word. Not one person ever said to him, "Why did you have a book on your head?" People, though, were a little standoffish, but they didn't know how to react. Now, people are so caught up in their role. We live in such narrow constraints. Nobody felt that it was in their right to walk up and say, "What's your game? What are you up to?"
Maybe they thought it was part of his job description.
No.
They probably thought he'd gone nuts.
Exactly.
Yeah,
they thought he'd gone nuts and he flipped out. But even then, no one came up and said, "Are you all right?" And all he was doing was trying to provoke them into reacting somehow, just to get people to respond and react.
Well, which is what we absolutely need to do. And at this time in our economic, global financial crisis, I think it's more important than ever that we actually do provoke people, because we can't go back and reinvent what we've done before because it didn't work. So,
text message from Peter in Beaumaris. On his deathbed, Maynard Keynes' last words were, anyone know? Saul, you're the economist.
No, I'm waiting to be enlightened.
I told you I was sick.
No, that was Spike Milligan. Maynard Keynes' last words, said Pete from Beaumaris, I wish I'd drunk more champagne.
Yes, I have heard that. Now that you remind me.
29 minutes to 12, Saul Eslake, who's an economist, chief economist with the ANZ. Tanya de Jong from Potpourri, who's helped work and set up this new organisation, Creativity Australia. They're our first guests, with Trevor Green, my co-host from the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. But let's just pause to get the latest fire information.
774 ABC Melbourne, your emergency services network. Bushfire information.
Megan Flamer.
Thanks, John. There is still an awareness message for the Kilmore East Murrindindi fire. Residents in the communities of Marysville, Buxton, Taggarty, Enoch Point and Jamison may be experiencing increased smoke due to southwesterly winds. To the south, fire activity has increased due to suppression activities to the northeast of Mount Juliet. This is causing considerable smoke currently around the Healesville area. No properties are currently under threat. Firefighters are constantly patrolling these suppression areas to monitor fire activity. There's also an awareness message for Christmas Hill, St Andrews and Smith's Gully near the Kinglake National Park. The Wilson's Prom Cathedral fire is not currently presenting a threat to any communities. The Bunyip Ridge fire, suppression work and construction of containment lines has continued in Jembrook, Nyalk and Lock Valley. The Melba Highway is still blocked. That's a full road closure between Dixon's Creek and Yarra Glen before the Kinglake turnoff.
I've had a text message saying it's open again now.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll double check that and get back to you. I spoke to Vic Roach about 5 minutes ago and they were saying,
they still
it's blocked. Still blocked, so I'll call the police.
Okay, I should make absolutely sure I'll just... Melbourne Highway is moving just at 11 o'clock. I had that text message.
Oh, okay, all right. I will call them again and we'll double check that.
Mind you, moving doesn't mean it's open, really, does it? Mm. Well, mind you, maybe it does. We better check.
Yep. We will. I'll check and I'll bring in some information for you. And for more information about the road closures, although I don't know that I want to recommend calling them now, call Vic Roads on 13 11 70. And just another reminder, 000 is still being inundated with calls of people saying they can see smoke. If you can see flame and you can identify where the fire is, then you should give them a call. Otherwise, call the Bushfire Information Line for more details, 1800 240 667. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Megan Flamer keeping you up to date, as we will continue to do throughout the rest of the fire season, which, as we are constantly reminding people, still has a fair way to go. Tanya De Jong, Saul Eslake from Creativity Australia are our guests on the Conversation Hour. Shortly we'll bring you in Brett Dean from the Australian National Academy of Music, Trevor Green, my co-host. Tanya, getting people to think creatively is one thing. Mm-hmm. Getting people to stay creative must be another. How do you do that?
Absolutely. One of the interesting programs that we're doing is a program of corporate and community choirs. And so the aim with those choirs is we do them for a minimum of a year, and that every 3 months there's a performance outcome. And in fact, some companies are seeing these like training and leadership programs for their future potential leaders. So their top 100 leaders, instead of doing a traditional training program, might sing in a choir for a year and build all their self-esteem, confidence, leadership and following skills, and start to really aspire to 10 weekly outcomes. And the aim with the choirs is that they're going to go and perform at local hospitals, charities, give something back.
So
the
people
start... Well, and they start to really feel better. We're doing some wellbeing surveys with the participants of choirs, and I think people will start to see an enormous increased satisfaction with life over time. So it has to be continued. You can't just do one-off creative activities, as Trevor would agree, wouldn't you, Trevor?
Yeah,
I mean, it's great to come to a symphony concert, but you've got to keep doing it. You've got to keep... I guess expanding your own creative thinking.
We do a lot of corporate work with the orchestra, and we take people, we've just done one with BHP Billiton, with all their senior executives who were flown into Melbourne from every headquarters in the world. And we did a music programme. We took Ravel's Bolero, which everybody knows, and we put them into different groups, 125 of the senior executives. We got some toys, I mean, percussion instruments, instruments that we put, professional conductor, members of the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra were there, and we created a performance of Ravel's Bolero. You've never seen the enthusiasm and the passion and the creative ideas of this executive, top executive team. It was quite stunning.
And were they otherwise musical?
Some of them never been near an instrument in their lives before, but I believe what Tanya's saying, there's something in everybody. People say to me frequently, I'm not musical. I say, oh, you don't like Frank Sinatra. Oh, I love Frank Sinatra. Terrific. They're musical. Anybody can see or hear. And it's so important in people's lives, and people don't register it. It's just there. It's background, but they love it. And they always say, I don't know anything about it. And yet they know. You say, pop, 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 pop. Oh, Beethoven. How many people know that little fragment? Mm. So people are more...
Well, that's the toilet paper ad, though.
Well, it's also... Well, it depends how old you are.
But it's also, I think, John, in Australia, we sort of have this value on sport and sports people, but we don't really value creativity.
But
as
sport is creativity.
Of course sport's creative as well. Sport is a highly creative...
Gary Ablett Jr. is about as creative as you can get.
No, but look, sport and art are equally important, and we don't rate well as an innovative nation because we don't nurture creativity and value it highly enough.
Creativity Australia. One more question, Saul. Saul Eslake from ANZ. Interest rates going to go down more?
Yes.
Oh, right, that was...
that was as unequivocal as you can get. No, look, I'm just
kidding. You're not going to talk about the economy. 23 minutes to 12 here on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. John Fain with you, Trevor Green, my co-host, Saul Eslake from the ANZ, but with his Creativity Australia hat on today, and Tanya De Jong from Potpourri, reminding you that the Rochford Winery Weekend Opera Under the Stars is on the 7th of March. That's coming up your way too.
Libby Gore.
Kate Blanchett is with you on the line on 774 ABC Melbourne.
Each weekday from 3 p.m.
I'm full of untold admiration for the firefighters, but also I do think that people who live in urban centres have an underlying respect and admiration for the resilience of people who live with these very extreme weather conditions, and our hearts are going out to them.
Libby Gore. On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music.
7 in the morning, step on the floor, walking through the kitchen and you open the door. Ain't much left in the bottle of juice, because the seeds that you planted never reproduce. Computer's still running, but your mind is cracked, because the plans that you made never came to pass. Now you're recognizing the times are hard when you're trying to take a bite at your ATM card. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Jimmy found out and stabilized at the age of 15 on the drink and drive. Seem to empathize, making babies in the backseat on tranquilizers. Papa never was much of Rolling Stones. He just liked to sit and drink alone. Mama always tried to do the best she could. She would work all day and come home to cook. But we all vain, we all strange, we all stained, we all love to just complain. But nobody wants to seem to get along. See, we got shame, we got pain, we got blame, we all a little bit insane. So that's why I sing this song, you know, because deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Even our worst enemies, Lord, they deserve music, music. And even the quiet ones in our family, they deserve music. Song, you know, because everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Even our worst enemies, Lord, they deserve music.
Michael Franti, everyone deserves music. How apt. With Spearhead there, Michael Franti, 18 minutes to 12 on The Conversation Hour. Trevor Green is my co-host. I'm John Fain. Saul Eslake, famed economist from the ANZ Bank, and Tanya De Jong from Creativity Australia have been our first guests. We're now joined by the bloke in charge of the Australian National Academy of Music, who have been through hard times but bounced back. Brett Dean, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How hard were the hard times?
Well, the hard times were challenging, that's for sure, because we found ourselves in a predicament where we were facing closure. But
doesn't get much harder than that, does it, Saul?
No. But, you know, we've actually found a lot of support in the community, and I think, also a new basis of a dialogue with the people that are, after all, giving us the money in the first place and were considering not giving us the money anymore. But I think that's also a relationship that's we've had to work at, but I think is now a lot better than it was.
Can you explain how you persuade people who are going to defund you? How do you explain to them and persuade them to refund you? What did you say?
Well, I think part of it was the groundswell of support that came, that even, I'd have to say, quite honestly, took us by surprise as an institution. I think what we've learnt from it is exactly that, the necessity for us to be able to articulate and advocate what it is we do. And I think if we've learnt something, it's exactly that, that it's fine for us to believe in the quality of the work that we do, which we stand by. And I think the programs we do speak for themselves in that regard. There's nothing quite like it in the rest of the music education sector in the country, in my opinion. But at the same time, that doesn't help if you don't clarify that to people that, after all, through no fault of their own, don't necessarily get what it is we do. It's a difficult and quite obscure concept for some people to quantify what makes good music education, for example.
Need to clarify what it is that you do and not assume everybody even knows, but we can confirm the Melba Highway up near Flowerdale is open. Sorry, no, near Yay. Melba Highway is now open. Speed limit is at 60 kilometres an hour for large stretches. There's a lot of traffic waiting to get through, but it is definitely open. But if you can avoid it and go around the Hume and around the back of Yay, that's a much better option. But the Melba Highway is now open. Not assuming everybody knows, what is it that you do that's different to, say, the Conservatorium, College of the Arts, or any of the other places around?
Well, what I think that we firstly do that's, I think, significantly different is that our course is a performance-based program, first and foremost, and performance is at the very centre of what we do. So that the whole program is defined by performance, by getting out there, and at the end of a year or however long the students may stay with us, they own the stage. They are, you know, they become stage animals, and just performance is in their very blood. That's not necessarily always so easily possible in the maelstrom of a tertiary conservatorium situation where you have hundreds of students all vying for their chance. That's the advantage of the size of the institution. We have 55 students. They all get enormous amounts of opportunities to be on stage, to perform also with members of faculty, with some of the finest artists from here and around the world. But coming back to the first question of yours, I think the other side of the coin is then for, and hopefully the learning curve on the politician side of the fence in what we went through last year is, I think that the politicians have every right to scrutinise how their money is spent. I've never had a difficulty with that.
How our money is spent.
Yes, that's a good point. But how that money is spent, that's absolutely fine, and I have no difficulties with that. But I think that it can only make sense if it's accompanied by an understanding or a will to understand what it is we do. And I think there the conversation will be a lot more fruitful this year than it was last.
The number of places, though, for people to go to get a musical education continue to expand. My worry is you're educating all these people across the board, you, the universities, College of the Arts, but I'm not sure there are jobs for them as professional musicians at the other end. And are we churning out people with ambitions that can't be matched?
Well, part of it is, I think, also seeing an education in music as part of an education of the person you are and the person that you become.
Yeah, but the reality is they want to be musicians.
Sure. I mean, look, I couldn't agree more that part of what we do has to be preparing and helping students find their way into the workforce. Now, because our students are at the elite and top end of the high achievers in the country, we actually have a pretty high record and an admirable record of helping our students find employment. But getting the job in the orchestra is one thing, and that's avoiding part of your question. I appreciate
that. It's all right, I'll toss it around to the others.
But, but also what kind of a life you then have in that orchestra is paramount. And part of our the importance of what we do, as I see it, is helping those musicians become more than just musicians. That is, that they're not just there to make up the numbers of the cello section of the MSO. They're there
not
to
that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but to contribute to the conversation of what the MSO is about and where it's headed.
Yeah.
And so what we endeavour to do, and this sort of touches on what you've been talking about earlier, Tanya, about the creativity side of things, is to engage other aspects of their education so that they leave our doors and leave our rooms with a bigger concept of where music is headed and what they can contribute.
I couldn't agree with you more about the education's about life. It's about training someone for the whole life. But also at the same time, you know, this turning out of lots of musicians for limited numbers, it's always been like that. It was like that in my student days, it's like it now. What we're finding is that standards are rising all the time, and standards have to rise all the time professionally. If we don't maintain these high standards, which are increasing worldwide, we won't survive. And I think the material that's coming out of the training that's going on to train these young musicians is what we require in the future. So there's always that competition for the best to get in, and we need the best. What we need to do, I think, with orchestras around the world generally, is to change the kind of lifestyle, to change the kinds of ways we get them access to an orchestra. And I think at the moment you join an orchestra, you're there for 50, 60 years, whatever it is, if you're young enough, feels like that sometimes.
50, 60?
Well, it can be certainly 40-odd years plus.
Get less and for murder.
Joined at the age of 10.
Yeah, well, but you know what I mean. It's a long time. I think the working environment needs to be looked at in some way to give these young people a great flexibility.
So well, the funny thing is that sort of Brad and Trevor have to make that case, and people in their positions and others who want to advocate for the arts continually have to make that case, and I think they need to make it more. But if we were sitting here talking about spending lots of taxpayers' money on the Australian Institute of Sport, we would not be talking about, gee, how did you survive being defunded last year, because that never would have been proposed. People who go to the Institute of Sport will probably be doing what they're trained to do there at our expense for maybe 10, 15 years tops, and you never ask, well, what are they going to do after that? Why are we spending all of that money on that? And there would never be any questioning about the need continually to be raising the standards, because that's what the rest of the world are doing. And I think that's the point Tanya was alluding to before, that we as a country do exceptionally well in sport because our culture values that and we put a lot of money into it, and the people who are good at it enjoy widespread respect. And deservedly so. We
and
all
financial
enjoy it.
Return. Most
and
of
indeed,
them, not
financially
all of them.
Return. People who are excellent or have the potential to be excellent in the arts, or for that matter the sciences, it's a continual battle to get funding, it's a continual battle to get respect. The support for what you do is very narrowly based, and in a sense, notwithstanding the outstanding small number of people we have who are world-class in that regard, we do less well than we can. We do less well than other countries of our size do because our culture doesn't value that sort of thing.
9 minutes to 12. I want to just slightly change the topic because we've got an opportunity between the four of you to head off in a different direction where you can shed some light on this as well. And back to you again, Saul. The arts industry is underwritten by taxpayers but heavily contributed to by corporate Australia. Indeed. Corporate Australia is undergoing, as is the rest of the world, a dreadful time. Share values are down 50, 60, 70%. Dividends are being wiped out. Profits, you know, all of that sort of thing, projections into the future, obliterated. Is corporate Australia going to stop putting money into the arts?
I think it's inevitable they're going to reduce what they do for the arts. And it's not just corporates either, John. It's also the philanthropic foundations and the individuals who, over a longer period than corporates, have been enormous benefactors and patrons of the arts. They don't have as much money to put into the arts and all the other things that they support. It's easy, unfortunately, for corporates to say, we're not going to make as much by way of direct sponsorship. We're not going to take our clients to arts events, which is also an important way that corporates do that sort of thing. Those budgets get cut back, and to some extent it's unavoidable.
So I think, what do you think the effect and the impact will be?
It will be negative, but I think there's a challenge on arts organisations and individual artists in these circumstances to redouble their efforts to engage with the corporate sector and to push the message that Tanya has been doing, that the arts is not just simply about entertainment, that the arts have things to offer the corporate world that can improve corporate performance. I go to lots of corporate events where I'm expected to speak about the things I know about. Next on the agenda is some sports hero who's there supposedly, and I'm not criticising them, to inspire business leaders, people who work in companies, to greater levels of performance and competition. Point I often find myself making in different circumstances is that people in the arts have skills and attitudes that are transferable to the corporate sector in ways that will improve the corporate's bottom line.
Yeah, but they're not the same as a retired AFL hero or someone who's had the baggy green on.
Only in our culture.
Yeah, I know.
If you were to go to other countries abroad, then you would find that. You would find musicians and painters and writers
inspiring people, not just Olympic
gold medals.
Sure.
And I think it is to some extent incumbent on people in the arts communities to sell themselves and their skills more, especially in these difficult times where cutting back on these sorts of things is a very easy decision for hard-nosed corporate executives to take.
And I think, you know, part of the training of elite musicians, and I'm an opera singer and I went through the VCA, and really it was really all about the performances and, you know, the elite performance, but we never really got a lot about being an entrepreneur, creating a business, how our skills might actually transfer to help businesses, how we might actually develop some business skills and perhaps be on a board that advises, you know, major companies.
It's going to have an effect. Trevor, have you already found money harder to get?
It is getting more difficult, yeah. There are signs, certainly with the philanthropic side. You know, a lot of our members are self-funded retirees, so there's a big hit there, and it's probably going to hit our single ticket sales as well, quite difficult. We don't know about that yet. With the corporate sponsors, they're getting more difficult to actually persuade, and they're pulling back in certain areas. But I still believe that there's an opportunity there. We've got three new sponsors last week. With this pending gloom and doom, you think, well, how have we managed to get three sponsors? There are three sponsors, and what we're developing is a social relationship with them, that it's not only about their organisation and corporate hospitality, it's about their organisation putting something in back into the community and using the MSO as the vehicle. That's where we're finding the real growth, and certainly education is a big, big area for us.
And speaking of students, they're going through hard times too, and fees, people pay fees to go to your college?
Well, they actually are on a bursary, on a stipend, which is part of, you know, how we're different to other institutions too. It's been part of the criticism about the academy, but I think actually the times at the moment justify even more so the fact that if we want to encourage the best musicians to succeed and to strive, then we may need to really assist them so that they don't have to, you know, spend hours a day flipping burgers, but can actually be honing their craft.
But if unemployment's going to go up to Saul, what, 7% we're being told?
By 2010 at least.
And we're being told that $42 billion needs to be put in order to pump up jobs for people. Surely someone is going to say, oh, come on, some of this namby-pamby art stuff is just not as essential as it might have been in your mind in the past.
Well, it's up to people like Tanya and ourselves to counter the argument and to put forward a strong case that we're all in this together, and actually to keep a sense of creativity alive. I think, you know, we're going to be just as important as you know.
And let's face it, we're not going to get through the current crisis if we don't think creatively. It is the only thing that's going to get us through.
Oh, and I think we undervalue actually how important these organisations are. You can see with the groundswell from the academy, which nobody expected, right across Australia and abroad and overseas as well. And the same thing goes for organisations like orchestras and theatre companies and things. People are so desperate and need this kind of relief from day-to-day problems.
But I think
there's a hope there. There's
you can see that we in the arts have been used to running scared and thinking that we're not really all that necessary because we're not thought of as necessary, and I think the tables have to turn and we have to have that courage to believe it ourselves.
Yeah, we have to stand up and
say.
Well, same thing happened when La Mama's funding was threatened, the theatre in Carlton. Not a lot of money, and they you know, the arts body said, oh, you've had a good run, you know, we've got to take your money away, and there was outrage. Well, good on you, Brett. Congratulations. Brett Dean, Artistic Director of the Australian National Academy of Music. Tanya de Jong from Potpourri, Rochford Winery on the 7th of March, Opera Under the Stars. But she's here with her Creativity Australia hat on, which is also the hat that the ANZ's Chief Economist Saul Eslake has been wearing as he's joined us on The Conversation Now today, co-hosted with Trevor Green from the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, Richard Stubbs.
Morning.
How are you?
Very well.
Exhausted?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Why do you ask?
Oh, but you're pushing on. Sunday you'll be hosting our broadcast from 10 o'clock for the National Memorial Service.
Yes, that's right. So sometime between then and there I'll sleep.
Yeah.
It'll be all good.
And then Tim Cox will host the broadcast from the Rod Laver Arena after 11 o'clock, the national coverage of the memorial service. So good on you.
So then a national show and then the national coverage of the memorial. So that'll be great.
But this afternoon?
This afternoon, all sorts of things. There was an interesting report handed down that by going to speak to Don Edgar, one of the co-authors of the report, that says that instead of being screening and stressing children's TV and technology, we should embrace it, that there's all sorts of good things that flow if kids play computer games and do things.
Mm-hmm.
And my first question was, who funded this report? But it seems to be independent. Yes. I think that'll be my first question to him
Don,
as well.
Don Edgar's very independent. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well...
But it's about balance, isn't it? I mean, you don't want to spend all day and all night in front of the screen.
Yes, but I have a feeling that software is developed along the lines that there's actual benefits from types of software.
And oh, well, so they've got longer thumbs now. Haven't they got more nimble thumbs? Right. Must be good for musicians.
It's got to be good, yeah, that's right. And
they're all double-jointed.
I'm just thinking of the game where you play, play by pressing the buttons.
Can your kids text without looking?
Double-thumbed? No.
Jack can. It's like touch typing, but they can text in the dark. They can do it without looking. It's just, I don't understand how.
Which isn't much, except it does say that the technology and its uses far exceeds what our rules of behaviour allow for. You know what I mean? We had a set, you should only have this or that. Well, I think the technology's jumped the riverbanks. And we need to discuss about whether it's awful and restrictive or whether we should use it in some way.
No, there's no turning back on it.
There's no turning back. That's right. Well, something about King Canute.
Yeah.
We'll talk about Tropfest. We'll go to Sydney. We'll talk to James Ballantyne. I'm going to drag a sports person in and have a chat about the bump. And not the dance step so much. No. But the
tribunal has overturned Mr. Maxwell's conviction,
which is significant, hugely significant in itself. And there's a few things about that too, so we'll have a chat about that. And because if it came up once, will it go again? What's the AFL doing exactly?
I don't mind a bit of a bump. It's part of the game, isn't it? So you're involved in football.
Biffo, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't Biffo.
That's rugby, isn't it?
It was elbow down, feet on the ground. Can you have an illegal outcome from a legal act?
Richard Stubbs with you on the radio this afternoon. The hard work this week done by Nicole Chavastek, Pete Dillon, Harriet Lonborn, Florenz Ron and Andrea Carson. I'm John Fain. I just sit here and talk. It's coming up to the news at noon.